As you and I know, every AA meeting, of whatever kind and purpose, is really a communion. And a communion is a time when we gather together under God's grace. We close every communion with prayer of our Lord. But before we come to that, I would like to recall to you that to us early people, and countless ones since, we have heard over the centuries the voice of Francis, one of the greatest followers of man. He has voiced our aspirations as none of us could. It is altogether fitting that you share with me your prayer of Francis. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O divine master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardon that we are pardoned. And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life.
There is nobody that I know who has followed the admonitions of Bill Wilson better than our speaker tonight. He's a lifelong friend of mine. We played in the junior leagues, the senior leagues, that was before little leagues. He was a star athlete on one of the greatest Charleston High teams ever, as well as one of the great Morris Harvey teams. He played with George King, who averaged 31.5 points a game, when 20 points a game was Herculean. For a period of time, was one of the managers of in the Hex organization and also assistant manager of our Civic Center. And throughout all of that, he and I, from time to time, would meet, and we were always dear friends, and occasionally we would drink together. And we knew everybody, and everybody knew Diz. And I was very surprised after I got back into the program after a 14-year vacation, in which I damn near died. And I got a call, and my friend, too, was sober down in South Carolina. And since that time, we have been in touch with each other regularly. He has spoken all over the country. He is an authority on the Big Book. He will tell you why we sometimes are in error to suggest reading the first 164 pages only. And if he doesn't tell you, I'm going to tell him to tell you before he gets done. He always tells you. It meant a lot to me. He sponsors people. He takes them to his home on Sunday, and they start with the flyleaf and go through the Big Book. He is probably, he has spoken to Jackson's Mill, and he has brought, on two occasions, people from down south, personally up there, to deliver messages. Many of you have heard CDs of the wonderful talk that those ladies have made. One particularly was one of the most inspiring I ever heard. there is nobody I know who has more fun in AA, but who also takes it more seriously. And we are very, very honored tonight, and I'm asked by his sponsee, Mac, to make amends. Mac was so disturbed that he had a family vacation planned and didn't know about it when we planned this. So he has sponsored everybody to, there's 100 sandwiches back there. Please take one to begin with, and then if there's something left over. But that is Mac's amend to Diz for not being here tonight. He's on a family vacation. So it gives me great pleasure to give you a man who I think truly symbolizes AA in the sense that it was meant by the early founders. My friend Diz.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Wow. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Diz Titcher. And my sobriety date is Cinco de Mayo.
All right.
1981. And my home group's a Mustard Seed group in Tallahassee, Florida. It's one of the best two meetings in the world. And my sponsor is a man named Tommy Hicks from Crawfordville, Florida. And he's not doing too good. He's got a debilitating lung disease, and I don't get to see him as much because he has a hard time talking. He's on oxygen 24/7. But we still got that togetherness whenever we go to a meeting, you know. It's really amazing. I feel like a criminal returning to the scene of the crime because this is where the beginning of my alcoholism started. And I also want to point out I got my daughter sitting over here with me, so I got to be pretty honest tonight. And then just to prove that the acorn don't fall too far from the tree, I got a nephew sitting right beside of her. Chuck Bradley. But I want to qualify something real quick. George and I didn't really drink that much together. However, we did drink a lot in the same bars. George and I went to different schools together. And I guess we're probably the last two relics of the 40s that you're going to see around here tonight, although there's a lot of gray hairs I see around here. You're making me feel very good. I want to thank George and Mac and anybody that had anything to do with inviting me here to be part of this. And I want to thank Jack Daniels and Jim Beam for making it possible for me to be here. I was born into a Presbyterian family. My mother and father were founding members of Westminster Presbyterian Church in Canal City. And I went to Sunday school and church there all through my early years up until my teenage years, and even when I entered college. And I never really got whatever it was I was supposed to get by doing all that. So when I was in college, I started going to different churches and trying to see if I could find it out what it was I was supposed to get. And I went to many churches, and I never did get it. I went to college, as George said, and Morris Harvey, and I was on a basketball scholarship there. And the first 2 months I was there, they had fraternity parties, and they rushed me to 2 fraternities. And the fraternity that I joined was called the Phi Sigs, and they was reprimanded by the president, I think, 7 times for rowdiness and drunken behavior. And I said, that's my kind of people. But I was a 17-year-old with a lot of veterans from World War II. And we had a break between 10 and 11. And all these veterans would like to go down to John Polly's. They had it downstairs there, and you could go in and get draft beer. And all those older guys would take me with them. And, you know, there I was drinking at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't think much of it. But that was just the beginning. And I was drafted in the Army, and of all places, I was sent with the Fort Knox, Kentucky, which is 31 miles from Louisville. And Louisville has 9 distilleries around it. And on Saturday morning, they gave tours and samples out. And if you had a good car, you could make three of those distilleries before they closed at 1 o'clock. You know, normal people don't do things like that, do they? But I served in the Army and got home and came back and went back to night school. I had a few more credits to get and got involved in my fraternity again. They had a float they was putting together, and so after work, I worked at Libyon's Ford too, and matter of fact, I want to make sure. I would take a six pack and go down to where they was putting this float together for the homecoming parade, and sorting goods department, I saw this pair of 7x35 binoculars. And I bought those, put them apart. I took all the guts out of them, and I lined them up on the inside. I put 6 ounces of booze in this one, 6 ounces of booze in that, put the caps on it, put that strap around my neck, right through that gap. Normal people didn't do things like that. I worked at that job for a couple more years, and then eventually my alcoholism kicked in pretty good, and I lost it, and I got a job traveling salesman. Now, that's a perfect job for an alcoholic. And I worked that job for 2.5 to 3 years, and one day I just said, you know, I'm not feeling very good. I don't know what's the matter with me, but I just couldn't fit a handle on it, so I called a good friend of mine. It was a psychologist. His name was McCoy, and I called in, and I said, Mac, I said, I got to come in and talk to you. I got something going on. I don't know what it is. And he said, all right, why don't you come in Thursday afternoon at about 3:30? And I said, okay. So I went and see Mac, and I said, he said, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. And I started telling him, and Mac just sat there and looked at me. You know, I talked for 3 hours. And Mac didn't say a word. All he did was look at me. I don't know whether he's in shock or frightened or what. But he said this. He said, I can't help you. But he said, I got a friend of mine I think can help you, and I wonder if you let me call him, and I'll see if I can't get you an appointment. I said, okay. So I went back to my apartment, and Mac called me the next morning and said, you got an appointment at 9 o'clock. You go down and see Dr. So-and-so. And I said, uh-oh. It was a psychiatrist. And I said, Mac thinks I'm crazy, and he just didn't want to tell me. But anyway, Saturday morning I got up, and I made it down there at 9 o'clock, and I went in that office, and I looked around on the wall, all these big diplomas and everything else. Psychiatric hospital, you know, doctor of psychiatry. And I said, oh, God, I'm in trouble now. And he came out, he said, your name Diz? And I said, yeah. He said, come on in. He introduced himself and said, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. I started telling a little bit about myself, and he said, yeah. He said, I can understand that. I looked at him, and I kept on talking. He said, yeah, I've had a couple of people do that too. And probably, you know, first hour and a half, he probably interrupted me about, you know, 25 or 35 times because he could identify with almost everything I was talking about. And so I just gave him the whole nine yards. You know, I just told him everything I could, and he didn't even blink an eye. He just could identify with everything. And after I finished, he said this. He said, you know, I think you're an alcoholic. I said, oh, hell, I wish I was crazy. But he said, I think it'd be all right if you just go to Alcoholics Anonymous. He pulled out one of those rare wins, you know, and he marked it down. He said, matter of fact, here's a couple of meetings I think you ought to go to. And I said, okay, so that next Monday, he had a meeting marked on Monday night, but I went out to work. I went out on the road, and I didn't get back until about 8:30 or so that night. And I get in my apartment, put my keys down and briefcase down, and sitting here getting ready to pour me a drink, and the telephone rang. And I went over and picked it up, and he said, you weren't at that meeting tonight. It was that psychiatrist. Hell, I thought you had a police force watching me and reporting on me. And I started to go into my dog and pony show. He said, listen, you don't have to lie to me. He said, just be at that same meeting I told you about tomorrow night. And I said, okay. And so I white-knuckled it the next day, and I managed to go to that meeting, and I got there early, and I sat on the third row. I didn't say nothing to nobody. Because I didn't know what was going on or anything else. I didn't know anything about anything. And, finally some guy came in like Chris here and opened the meeting up and everything else. And I started watching the fly around. And all of a sudden I look out the window and I said, oh, God, there's somebody up there messing around. So I didn't hear what went on at all. And somebody got up and talked and spoke, and I didn't listen too much to him. I probably had about 5% discipline on listening. And all of a sudden I kind of looked down at the end of the road down there, and there's a face down there looking at me, and it was that psychiatrist. And I said, hell, he's in AA too. So after the meeting, I went down to see him, and he said, Diz, how you doing? I said, pretty good. He said, you don't look very good to me. And he said, here, I'm going to tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go to the grocery store and get you 2 great big bottles of honey. And every time you get a desire to take a drink, just take a big tablespoon of honey. It quiets out imperialist urge. And it does, but I went through about 8 or 10 of those things the first 2 weeks. But you know, there's something about that meeting that I kind of liked, so I kept coming back. I kept coming back to that meeting and coming back to that meeting, and every now and then I'd hear what you all say. I heard you say, well, you got to work those steps. And so one night I came in early and I looked up on that wall and I worked them steps. It took me about 20 minutes. And some of the other stuff I didn't say. You know, I was going to a meeting for 14 months. And all I ever had was an off-the-wall program. And finally, I went to another meeting one night, and Monday night, I went to a different meeting. And after the meeting, I was talking to a couple guys and got a tap on the shoulder. Turned around and looked, and I saw this old man standing there. He says, your name Diz? And I said, yes, it is. He said, well, my name's Slick, and I'm your new sponsor. And I turned around, and I said, who said so? He turned around and pointed. He said, you see those 3 guys standing over there? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I drew straws, and I lost. And right then and there, something came over me. I couldn't identify it. I didn't know what it was at all. I later found it in the big book on page 387. But I turned to that old man. I said, okay, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, I want you to come over to my house Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock. And I said, okay. He told me where he lived. We didn't have GPS then. I had to look it up on a map. And so I went over to his house at parked my car and got out and walked up there at 2 o'clock. He met me at the door. And he took me into the kitchen. He had a big white porcelain table sitting there with big white legs and heavy white chairs and those old white heavy porcelain cups you get, you know. And he had a coffee pot on the stove, Perkin. And he just poured that coffee pot and said, you want a cup of coffee? I said, yeah. So he poured me a cup of coffee, poured himself a cup of coffee and sat down. He said, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. And I start telling him a little bit about myself, you know, who I work and who I'm single, et cetera. And he told me that he was a newspaper man and he'd been in AA for 22 years. And the first thing you know, we start identifying with one another, different things. And we've met, talked for about 2 hours. He looked at me and said, hey, you believe in God? I said, I don't know whether I do or not. He said, well, we're not going to worry about it right now. We'll talk about that later. He said, that's about enough for the day. He says, you can go ahead and go and come back next Sunday. And next Sunday, bring your big book. You got one? And I said, yeah. And I said, okay. But, you know, I walked down there and I felt real good. I knew that this was going to be something that I really wanted. And I could hardly wait till next Sunday came along. And Finally, it did come. And I pulled into his house at 2 o'clock. He met me at the front door and took me in that kitchen, set me down at that porcelain table. Gave me a cup of coffee in them big old heavy coffee cups. And he started talking. He said, well, he said, open up your big book. And I opened it up, and he said, what do you see? I said, nothing. He said, that's right. That's about all you know about alcoholism. And I said to myself, I ain't going to like this. I ain't going to like where this is going at all. And if it continues, I'm going to get up and walk out of here. And, buddy, you know what he did? He went through this book, and he started explaining it to me. He said, you know, first thing you think of the title page. He said, the next thing you see is other books. He said, those are all conference-approved literature there. He said, if it's not published by AA, it's not conference-approved. He said, you have a second title page. Under that, you have the first promise in the big book. It says how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. So it starts right off with the promise from the big book. You go through, and it gives you the contents of the book. And he explained that to me, you know, that doctor's opinion, Bill's story, and here's a solution. Step one, he gave one more on alcohol's way, agnostic. Step two, how it works, interaction, working others. Step 3 through 12, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then he explained all these stories in the big book. And as he kept telling me, just turn the page and got to the preface, and he said, read that second paragraph to me. And I said, well, because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large number of alcoholic men and women to recover, there exists strong sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. He said, you know what a textbook is? I said, yes, sir. I went to college. I said, I had many textbooks. He said, that's what this is, a textbook. He said, this textbook is meant to be studied. You don't read this book. You read newspapers and you read magazines. But this book you study. And you study for two reasons. Because the information in here is going to put you in recovery and keep you in recovery. And he said, the other thing, the information in here is going to help you to help somebody else get into recovery. He turned it. And he said, the bottom of the preface, I like to read this because you all might pass it up. It said, if you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me or more important. Yes, I felt like that or more important. Yes, I believe this program can work for me too. It says hope in there. That's one of the first assets of this book, first principle of the book. And there's probably 180 principles in this book. If you just look for them and find them. Everybody thinks the principles are the steps, and that's not true. There's other principles in this book. But it calls attention to read the stories in the big book, because back when this book was printed, there was only 3 meetings. There was only once a week you'd go to a meeting. So Bill wanted to make sure if you could identify with the stories in the big book, then maybe you'd come to the Alcoholics Anonymous. And still today, that's very important. Read the stories in the big book. Got over the forward of the first edition. He said, read me that first paragraph. We're part of that first paragraph. That we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. He said, do you understand what that means? And I made the first damn mistake I ever made with a sponsor. I said, I think I do. And he listened to me about my thinking. He told me my best thinking got me to AA. And so I wasn't allowed to think anymore. But he said, your problem's not alcohol, drinking alcohol. Your problem's a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. He said, your problem is the way you think and the action you take on your thinking. He said, we'll talk about that a little later. But he said, the other thing is, the next sentence, read that. I began to think he couldn't read. to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered, the main purpose of this book. You get your people in the book. You don't tell them anything. You show them.
Right.
You show them what's in this book. And if you've got some wild thing that you try to do on your own, then you're not going to be very successful. So he kept turning pages, you know. He talked about the forward to the second edition, the histories in here, and he goes through and explains a little bit about the history. Forward to the third edition, fourth edition, he explained all that to me. And then he went through the doctor's opinion, explained that to me. But he said, I want you to turn to page 30. So when you turn to page 30 in this book, he said, I want you to read that second paragraph. And I said, we learned that we had to fully concede to innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. They said, do you understand what that sentence means? I said, well, most of it. I said, I know that fully means completely, and I know concede. I was a history major in college, so I know that concede was surrender. And I said, our innermost self, I guess, is my mind. He said, uh-uh. Your innermost self is what makes you tick right here. And he said, that's where you accept your alcoholism, right here, not up here. He said, this will destroy you. He said, this is where you accept it. And he said, I'm going to prove that to you. He said, go over to page 55. And 55 says, read me the second paragraph. It says, actually, we're pouring ourselves for deep down, and every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And he explained to me that since I was born, the fundamental idea of God has been in me ever since I was born. But you know, because of all those years of all that self-destruction I've done, I'd put so much crap inside me that God was not allowed to work within me. Not one single bit. And he explained to me, he says, it tells you why. It may be obscured by calamity. In 1938, when this book was printed, calamity meant problems and trouble. He said, but pomp. You know how much we try to make something out of nothing. Yeah. And the last thing is, but worship other things. And I did. I worship money, women, and whiskey. Not necessarily in that order, but... And you know, and that's why God wasn't able to work in my life. Now, how did Bill Wilson know this? Well, when you go back and you read Bill's story, he tells you about it. Because he gets a visit by this old schoolboy friend of his named Ebbie Thacker. He was sober, it says on page 9. You read a little bit further down, he said there was something about his eyes. Did you ever notice a sober person's eyes? They can look at you. When they're not sober, they're dancing all over the damn thing. Right? But he knew it. He said, he's sober. Got down further and he said, I got religion. Boy, that turned Bill Wilson off. You know, he wasn't interested in religion of any kind. And then he went down and explained what had happened to him. He said he was up in Vermont and he was taking care of his family house up there and he was drinking and carrying on and everything else. And he had been arrested 4 times for public intoxication. Well, it was a blue law in Vermont that if you was arrested 3 times, you got sent to the asylum. And so the judge said, hey, go get Abby. We're going to have to sentence him. Constable went over to get Abby and brought it, told him to clean up his stuff and come up to the judge on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the judge's son was in a fellowship called the Oxford Group. His name was Seaver Graves. He called his dad and he said, hey, we know Ebbie. If we come up there, would you put him in, give him to us and we'll bring him down to New York and we'll try to help him. The judge said, okay, you better get him out of Vermont. And so 2 men, Roland Hazard and Shep Cornell, appeared before Judge Graves and asked that Ebbie be turned over to him. And the judge looked and said, Ebbie, you want to go with these 2 men or do you want to spend 6 months in the asylum? Hell, that don't take a genius to figure that one out, does it? He said, I'll go with them. And so that's what he told Bill Wilson, how he was rescued. And they told him a simple religious program and a practical program of action. Wow. The Oxford Group told Ebbie Thacker that. But then also, over on page 11, he explains what his friend brought to him. All these things on page 11. But down in the bottom of the last paragraph, it says, here was something at work in the human heart, which had done the miraculous. So Bill Wilson realized that Ebbie Thacker had his alcoholism under control within here. Not here. Here. And he was sober. And Bill Wilson realized that, so that's what he did. That's half of step one. So those of you that's had unmanageable lives, how are we going to handle that? Well, Slick said turn to page 52. Second paragraph again. Second paragraph seems to have everything in it, doesn't it? It said there's 8 human problems of all alcoholics. The first one is we were having trouble with personal relationships. Anybody in here have trouble with personal relationships? Yeah, but I had to put those on paper and I had to list all my personal relationships that I had problems with. Second thing he said, we couldn't control our emotional nature. Well, that's true for an alcoholic. We're either happy or we're sad. You know, we're either jealous or we're, you know, what? We just go from one extreme to another. And the third thing is we were a prey to misery and depression. If you're an alcoholic, you're going to suffer depression. I don't care what you say, because scientifically, alcohol is a depressant. That's what works on you.
Right.
So you're going to suffer that. Our co-founder, Bill Wilson, suffered 12 years with it. And you're going to have it. But you again, if it's very severe, don't try to take care of it in AA. Go see a therapist, or if necessary, a psychiatrist. Let them take care of it. We have no opinion on medical views whatsoever. And the third one is couldn't make a living. Now, that don't mean hold down a job. Living encompasses paying your bills, talking to your kids, calling your mom and dad, doing all those things that you should be doing while you're living. The next one could be, we had a feeling of uselessness. Oh, that's a big one. Huh? And we were full of fear. Bill always managed to disguise fear. He always put them down at the end of something instead of up front. I had all kinds of fear. And we were unhappy. And the last one is, we couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. Those are the unmanageable things in my life. You know? And I wrote them all down on paper. And I got a good look at all those things that was the matter with me. And Slick said, that's pretty much step one. I said, now turn over to page 45. And I said, okay, so turn down. I had to go back. And I think it's page 40. Yeah, 45. It says, lack of power. That was our dilemma. And I said we had to find a power greater than ourselves. We had to find a power with which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, the next sentence tells you. Well, that's what this book is about. Its main object to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problems. Don't say we'll help you solve your problem. It tells you this will solve your problem. Yeah. All right, people want to put extra words in here sometimes. You turn that page, here comes a big one, nobody does this. Right in the middle of the page in 46, we found out as soon as means right now, we were able to lay aside prejudice. Anybody take time to lay aside prejudice? Slick asked me what my prejudices were about the church. And I said, basically, I didn't like that guy sitting up there in that pulpit telling me what I had to do. And been a few other things. He said, well, if you want to go forward, you got to lay those things aside. Because you got to be open-minded if we want to continue. And I told him, okay. And it says, then even express a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commence to get results. Just be willing to believe in a power greater than myself. This chapter, We Agnostics, is the only chapter ever written in any book that tells you who God is and where he lives. Yeah. No other theological Bible or anything else tells you that. Only this book for alcoholics that tells you that. This whole week, agnostic, there's a kind of an equation in here. It tells you you got to be willing. And it says you got to be willing to believe. And you got to believe you can get sober. You got to believe you can have a better life. If you make a decision on those beliefs and you take action on that decision, you're going to get results. And from those results, you're going to have belief that your earlier belief was true. And that's called faith. Now, in order to get through this to people, Bill Wilson put in this book on page 51, 3 people. The only time he ever put personal or people's names in here. And all three of these people had a belief. First one he had was Columbus. Second was Galileo. And the third one's the Wright brothers. Now, personally, I thought the Wright brothers were sniffing glue. Well, they were bicycle mechanics, and they thought they could fly. But let me tell you what they did. They had this apparatus that they put together, and they called the Weather Bureau there in Dayton, Ohio, where they lived, find out where the best winds in America was. And the Weather Bureau said, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. They put this apparatus on a truck and took off to Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. They got the biggest sand dune over there. And they built this catapult. And they put that apparatus at the top of that, and Orville got in there, and they cut him loose, and he come down that catapult, went up. He flew 219 feet. People wouldn't print it in the newspapers because men can't fly. That's left to birds. But see, they had a belief they could fly. They made a decision on that belief. They took action on that decision. They got results from their action.
Yep.
And they had faith that their original belief was true. Now, Galileo is a little bit different. Galileo was one of the big professors over at a big university in Rome. And he wrote a paper called The Laws of Falling Bodies. And in that paper, he stressed that the earth was the center of the universe. And the church got a hold of that. And they called him in and said, Galileo, you're wrong. Aristotle and Copernicus says that the sun is the center of the universe. You either repent all this or you're going to be under house arrest. He wouldn't take it back. And they put him under house arrest. And for over something like 55 or 56 years, he was under house arrest. But listen what happened. His students believed in what he wrote and what he said. And they went out and they started teaching it. And pretty soon it was all over the place that the earth, that the sun was the center of the universe. Church called Galileo in and said, we're letting you off the house arrest. You're right. And your students proved it for you. Well, that's not the last of that deal because about 2 years ago, the church finally said, after 400 years, they're going to put a statue of Galileo up in St. Peter's Square. You think you had a resentment that long? But anyway, Columbus. Well, we all know, heard about Columbus. We read about him in school. But the thing you don't know is that he may be the first alcoholic on record. Well, listen, when he left Spain, he didn't know where he was going. And when he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he went back, he couldn't tell anybody where he had been. And he did it all on somebody else's money. So anyway, Bill Wilson proved his point. He believed that he wrote about belief in here, and he said we had to do it. So on page 53, we take our second step because it said, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, that's our alcoholism. And we could not postpone or evade it. And then we had to fearlessly face the proposition, either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And Slick said that unless I made that choice, I couldn't go on to step three, because if I did, I'd be going there with self-will. And he said, I want you to take some time because you've got a little problem. And he said, let me know when you start believing. And after about 2 weeks, I said, you know, I believe in a higher power. He said, that's fine. We can get started. So he turned over to page 60. I'm sorry. I'm not even very good today, am I? 60, and it says in here, being convinced we were at step three. What are we convinced of? Well, right above us is ABCs. And the ABCs are the first, the step one and step two. So we're convinced of the steps. Step one and step two. And if we're convinced of them, then we are at step three. And we can continue on. He said, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understand him. Just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? Well, our will is the way we think.
Right.
And our life is the action we take on our thinking.
Yeah.
So consequently, that's what I had to turn over to God, the way I think. Now, what does that mean? Well, further on it says, any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And it said, further down, read this. He said, each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. He said, you know why Bill Wilson put the word actor in there? He didn't know your name. And then, so if you, from here on out, the next 3.5 pages, if you take the word him, his, himself, and everything else, and put your name in it, you're going to find out what your problem is real quick. All right. Second thing is, and just what do we do? Well, the answer of page 62 says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Most of us played God when we were trying to run everybody else's lives. Tell them what to do. We had to quit doing that. It says next. Now, there's a time period. It says next, we decided to hereafter in this drama life that God was going to be our director. He's the father, and we're his children. He's the principal, and we're his agents. And so you're going to make that simple little decision for step 3. And we're going to hold on to step 3 because it's not finished. Because in order to do something about our will and our life, we're going to have to continue on to step 4, 5, 6, 7. But anyway, I talked to Ann this morning. She likes that third step. And she told me that this guy back here told her about that third step. And that third step is beautiful, and I want to remind you that it was written by an alcoholic. He didn't have any references when he wrote this book. So he didn't get any help from anybody. And there's a hook in that third step, prayer. That hook is, relieve me of the bondage of self. Now, it doesn't say relieve me of the bondage of alcohol there. It says relieve me of the bondage of self. My problem's not alcohol. I told you that in the first forward. My seemingly hopeless state of mind is my problem. So I've got to take care of myself. Down at the bottom says, next we launch out on a course of vigorous action. First step of which is a personal house cleaning. So step 4. Now, you all probably don't pay attention to it, but before that, Bill compares this inventory to a business inventory. You know? And he compares it, you know, fact-finding and fact-facing. That's searching and fearless. You know, the whole thing is just like it's written in a 4th step. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestation. There are 3 common manifestations of self that we've got to look at. Resentments, fear, and sexual misconduct or harm to others. And it tells us what we've got to do with those resentments, you know. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. It said, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. You ever think about that? You can't straighten out one way and try to help the other two. Mentally, you can't get better spiritually and physically. Physically, you can't get better spiritually and mentally. But if you get it better spiritually, you're going to get better mentally and physically. It's amazing. It works. It said, we listed people, institutions, or principles. Well, I'm not going to bore you with what people are. You know that. We all had resentments against people. We did that when we did our first step. And we all know institutions, you know, police, courts, lawyers. we all got resentments against them. But how about the principles? People don't look at principles today. But, you know, back in on page 27, we had this Roland Hazard visited Carl Jung. And Carl Jung told him what principles were. Page 27, it says, ideas, emotions, and attitude, which were one of the guiding forces of these lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptual notions. Whatever the principles that have been guiding your life since you was born are what you got to look at. I can't do that. I'm not good enough. He's a lot smarter than I am. If you look at all those things that have been guiding your life and you're willing to do something about them, you can do it through the inventory process. And you get a good look at what you were really like. Fear, when I got to putting down my fears, I listed 66 of them. And the reason I listed 66 of them, because over on page 62, it talks about selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble, driven by 100 forms of fear. Well, Bill got 100 for him, and I only got 66. But anyway, they were enough to cause me a lot of problems. Now, sexual misconduct, well, I was just about like everybody else there. I did all those things that I wasn't supposed to do, but I don't usually disclose that from a speaker standpoint. I kept that for my sponsor, the person listening to my fifth step. And when I finished this inventory, Slick wanted to look at it. I took it over to his house. He looked at it. And he said, you don't have God down on this list. Yeah. And I said, no. He said, don't you think you ought to put him down on there? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, list all those things that you can't get along with him. List all those things down there. How that affected you. And I said, okay. And so I had to go back home and had to put that down and fill that back out again. And then I came back over to him and he said, fine, you did a good job. I said, I want you to call Clarence. Clarence was his sponsor. Make an appointment, go see Clarence, and you do your fifth step with Clarence. And I said, okay. So I called Clarence and I went up there. Did his house and I gave him my fourth step, and I went ahead and started doing it by memory. And every now and then, he'd have to remind me of something, and I'd go over it, and I pretty much went over everything it was. And one time, Dorney said this. He said, how come you don't, you got God down on your inventory list? And I said, Slick God don't like me. I mean, Clarence Slick don't like me. And Clarence looked at me and he said, Diz, you're not big enough for God to dislike. And he said, you've been going at it all wrong. He said, you've been trying to barter with him. You've been trying to make deals with him and everything else. And all you have to do is just make a simple little prayer and ask him to guide your life today. And after tonight, you say, thank you. That's all you have to do. And from that point on, that's what I started doing. Every morning I get up, I ask God to enter my life and guide me as I go through the day. At nighttime, I thank him. And we get into some big trouble, God knows. And we don't do a bad job. 6 and 7 you can find on page 76. Two prayers. But it says you got to get ready to, you know, to list these character defects. And there are character defects all through the book, you know. I think if you turn them over to page 263, Dr. Bob explains about 8 or 9 character defects in there. But I listed my character defects, and Clarence was writing them down. And he told me something very important. He said, Diz, the principles in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous will get rid of every one of your character defects if you just study and do what this book tells you. And within time, he was absolutely right. It didn't come overnight, but within about 3 years or 3.5 years, most of my character defects was gone. I moved on to Steps 8 and 9, it's right on the same page. Steps 8, not too much there. It says basically, you know, you made your list in your fourth step. And so he said, go get your fourth step and you'll find out all those people you have to make amends to. And then Slick said he went up to the 12 and 12 and on page 81, he barred the information on that because there's 4 columns. That 12 and 12 says you've got to put these people's names down in. And he suggested I put the people I can get to real, real quick in the first column. The people aren't get to next in the next column. The people aren't get to later in the next column. And the fourth column, anybody on here I could put down. And pretty much that's the way it worked. So I went through that first column pretty much real quick. Second column a little bit tougher, a little bit longer. Third column a little bit longer. And after about 5 years ago, I still had two amends I needed to make, and I had those in my coat pocket to make them. And I always wanted to try to make them. And the possibility I couldn't be in the same place because the men said make direct amends. They don't say make them on the telephone or anything else. So I couldn't make a direct amend, so I just got to keep carrying that card around. One of these days, maybe I can get her done. The best amend that I've ever heard. And in 2002, I went to a meeting with my friend Carl Armstrong. We went to a meeting something like 18 years together. And on Thursday night, we could sit in an area where we could see everything in the room. And I looked over the door, and I saw a lady come in there, and boy, she was a looker. I hit Carl, and I said, look. And he looked over and said, yeah. And she went over and sat down. And the meeting got over. And Carl and I got up, and we was talking to a few other people. And Carl said, you better turn around. Somebody wants to talk to you. I turned around and looked, and there was that girl that came in there late. And I looked at her and said, how are you? She said, is your name Diz? And I said, yes, it is. She said, well, she said, I want to know if you'll sponsor me. And I say what I say to every person that asks me that. I said, are you willing to follow a few simple suggestions? And she said, yes. I said, well, sit down here and let's talk about it. And so I told her that I was retired and, you know, and I was married and my time was pretty important. And she told me where she worked and she was a single mother. And I said, well, you know, there's a bagel shop close to where you work there. And I said, why don't we meet there on Monday for lunch? And she said, okay. We started meeting there Monday for lunch. And I started going through this book just like Slick did with me. And one time I was talking, I said, you told me that you tried AA two other times and it failed. Do you know why you failed? And she said, yeah. She said, I kept a lot of things to myself. And I said, well, like what? And she said, well, I had an abortion. I said, well, that's no big thing. We can handle that. I said, we handle those things very easy in AA. And then she looked at me and she said, I had four abortions. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stammered me, but I said, well, we'll handle that when we come around. So we got to the fourth step on our sexual inventory, and I asked her to list those four abortions down there, who the person responsible with her, and time of it and everything else, and much of the information she could put down on. And she was just going, taking this program just really good. And then we got to making the amends lesson. She had her mother down, her father, her brother, and a couple boyfriends, a couple girlfriends, people she worked with. She just had a great list. And I said, well, that's good. You've done a good job. And she said, well, what am I supposed to do about those abortions? I remember something that said in the big book about writing a letter. And I said, Angie, I want you to write God a letter. And I want you to explain everything you can about each one of these abortions. As much information as you can put down on there. And I said, and I don't want to read the same letter twice. And she just gave me that deadpan look, and she said, okay. And so she went back to work, and the next Monday when we came in, we were talking about some of the men she had to make when she was going to go back to Arcadia in California. It's on the coast. And she was taking her kids back there and going to visit with her family and everything. She said, I'm going to make amends then. And I said, well, Angie, good. I said, find a place where you could be really quiet, somewhere in God's world, and read those letters to God. And I said, then after you finish up with those letters, just tear them up. He said, all right. So she was gone 2 weeks to Arcadia, California, and she came back in town. She called me up, and she said, hey, I'm back. She says, can we meet? And I said, yeah, I'll be there. So we met and talked about a few things, you know, getting back to work, getting the kids in school, et cetera. And I said, how'd your amends go? She said, oh, it went good with my mom and dad and my brother and a couple old boyfriends and everybody else. And I said, that's good. And she said, but one morning I woke up and everybody was sleeping. It was kind of quiet. And she said, I had those letters in my pocket. And she said, I just walked over to the ocean where I played around when I was a kid. And she said, they had this inlet that came in from the ocean. And that's, right at that inlet was this great big rock. She said, I used to climb that when I was a kid. She said, nobody was around, so I climbed up on top of that rock. She said, I thought that was probably as close as I could get to God. I said, all right. She said, I sat down up there, and so I said my little prayer first, and then I pulled those letters out of my pocket, and I read each one of them individually. And she said, after I read the last letter, she said, I took them and I tore them up. I tore them up in a lot of pieces, and she said, I just took them, I threw them up in the air. And she said, a gust of wind came and picked up those papers and took them out and dropped them in that inlet. And she said, when she looked out in the ocean, she saw four baby whales.
Oh,
and she knew her prayers had been answered.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
She has the best relationship today with her higher power of anybody that I've sponsored. Mm-hmm. She finally got married. She moved to Jacksonville, Florida. She goes to AA. She helps other people. She don't hold nothing back anymore.
Mm.
She's just a wonderful individual. Step 10. Well, we finally get to a place. It says we have entered the world of the Spirit. And by getting to the world of the Spirit, we do two things. We grow in understanding and effectiveness. You know, we know a lot about this program now. And we know how to work it. Not only can I work it in my life, but I can help you work it in your life. It also tells us that we got to continue doing some things. And what we continue doing is step 4 through 9 on a daily basis. And Slick suggested to me that I get a 10-step buddy. And if I offend anybody, that I should call him immediately instead of trying to get a hold of him. And I said, okay, so I have a 10-step buddy. Down in the promises on the bottom of page 84 and over to 85, one of the things it says, sanity will have returned. And that's very important. Because over in the next page it says, we're going to get our will back. You know, it wouldn't work the other way around. You know, because the will we're going to get back is the one that we have aligned with God's will. You know, then another thing it promises on that bottom of the page says, we have developed this vital sixth sense, God consciousness. We use that sixth sense the same way we do our other five senses. Step 11, prayer and meditation. Actually, 21 spiritual exercises I got to do on a daily basis. When I get up in the morning, as I go through the day, and when I retire at night. There's a hook in there, though. The hook is, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness. And I asked Slick about that. And he said, well, you've made your review. In the first step, you looked at your 8 human problems. Your fourth step, you looked at your resentment, your fears, and your sexual misconduct. You looked at all your character defects, and you made amends. So you made your review. Now you can go to God and ask Him for forgiveness. And again, I said to suggest that you do that outside of God's Word. And that was a very humble, humble experience. I spent not 5 minutes, 10 minutes, I spent about an hour and a half. And that was one of the second most important feelings I've ever had. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening. Well, Dr. Silkworth said we have a psychic change. Carl Jung said we have a spiritual experience. William James says we have a spiritual awakening. And Bill Wilson says we have a personality change. All those must come as a result of working the steps. You don't get them by osmosis or sitting out in the sun or anywhere else. All right, we try to carry this message. This message.
Right.
Not your message or George's message. The message that's in this book. And you carry them to alcoholics, not workaholics. Alcoholics. And the last thing is, you practice these principles in all our affairs. I'm going to start there because Bill Wilson made it very easy because practice these principles in all our affairs. 1938, all our affairs was the next three chapters. Two wives, the family afterwards, and two employers. So I had to work all these principles in my marital life, in my family life, and in my employer. And I try to do that today. I try to stay in touch with everybody that I possibly can. Carry this message to alcoholics. About five Christmases ago, I got a Christmas card. I got a lot of Christmas cards, but I got a special Christmas card. And my wife even said, "Hey, it's from Sue." And I opened it up, and she wished Nancy and I a very, very Merry Christmas. But inside she had a little letter, and opened that letter up. And Sue had heard me speak one Wednesday night, and after the words had came up and thanked me for being here and said, "I could identify with a lot of things that you talked about, and I wonder if you'd be my sponsor." Well, that kind of gagged me, and I didn't know what to say. And I said, "Give me your phone number and let me get back to you on that." It's too late to call Slick, so next day I called him. He told me to come over. Found him over the house. He told me to look at page 60, and I said, "All right," so read the 12th step to me. I said, "Having had a spiritual awakening, there's all these steps to try to carry this message to alcoholics." He said, "Read that last sentence." I said, "We try to carry this message to alcoholics." "Read it one more time." I said, "We try to carry this message to alcoholics." "Does it say in there that you don't carry them to anybody else?" He said, "If they're an alcoholic, Des, carry the message to them." And they looked at me and he said, "And the day you can't do that, get the hell out of this fellowship because we don't want you." And so I called that little lady up and I said, "I'd be honored to sponsor you. And where do you work?" She told me work at the post office. "Where you live?" She told me where she lived. And in between the two spots and close to where I lived, there was a park. And I said, "How about Miss Me at that park after you get off work at 4 o'clock? She said, "Okay." And so when she first met there and we sit out at that picnic table, I looked at her and said, "You're willing to follow a few simple suggestions?" She said, "Oh, yes." And I'm telling you, she was just a highlight. We went through this book and she dearly loved this book. She did everything really exceptionally well. She went in this fellowship, she would chair a meeting, she would sponsor people. She was just, the bright eye of all my recovery. I just loved Sue. And she called me up one day and she said, "Charlie?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, he asked me out." I said, "Well, what'd you say?" She said, "Des, I don't know how to date." She said, "All I used to do is go out, get drunk, go to bed, go home." And I said, "Well, Sue, what did he say he's going to do?" He said, "Well, he said he's going to go to a movie." I said, "Sue, go to a movie." So she went to a movie. Next week, she called me up and she said, "Charlie?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, he wants to take me out to dinner." I said, "What'd you say?" I said, "I didn't know what to say." I said, "Sue, go out to dinner. Enjoy your dinner with him, Try to converse with him." Okay. So this went on. They were dating, going to pick, going everything else, and everything. Finally, she called me up one night, and she said, "Charlie?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "He asked me to marry him." I said, "What'd you say?" She said, "I said yes." So anyway, they got married, and I went to the wedding, and then they moved up to a little town about 40 miles away, and I didn't get to see her much, but she wouldn't get anybody else to work with. She kept working with me. She'd call me once or twice a week or something like that. But then when I moved, you know, we got more distance apart. And what she said in this letter, though, she said, I wanted to go Christmas shopping. So instead of going down the interstate, I went the back way. And as I went back the back way, I went by that General Green Park where we used to go and sit at that picnic table. She said, I parked my car. And she went over and she said, I sit at that picnic table. And she said, I thought of all the many times that you had gave this program to me in bits and pieces. And she said, Diz, I've been sober 26 years. I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, I love you. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Diz Titcher.
All right. I have one for you just like it. Now, that is mine. Yours is down there. They wanted you to have one of these from the club. And here is a WV hat that I know you'll wear. There you go. Here. God bless you.
Thank you, Diz.
There it is.
Thank you.
We also have a, if I can run this machine, we have a special way of closing. When I was given a copy of this by Byron, God bless Byron, who's in the CD business, he's helped so many of us. I thought this would be a nice way to close.
Let's close your eyes. A little
better. We get your bell.
I'm going to have to listen to the prayer again, then the Lord's Prayer will come right after us.
As you and I know, every AA meeting of whatever kind and purpose is really a communion. And a communion is a time when we gather together under God's grace. We close every communion with prayer of our Lord. But before we come to that, I would like to recall to you that to us early people and countless ones since, we have heard over the centuries the voice of Francis, one of the greatest followers of the Master. He has voiced our aspirations as none of us could. It is altogether fitting that you share with me your prayer of Francis. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardon that we are pardoned. And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life.
Now the Lord's Prayer.
Now let us conclude. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.